All right, so it is Friday, December 10th, and we're meeting with Paul Gray at New Life in Christ. And Paul, why don't we go ahead and start off, first of all, by getting your permission that you're okay with having this interview put on to our publicly accessible internet archive.
I give you permission to do that. That's fine.
Perfect. Well, why don't we start then by having you just share a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you came from, and just so that we can get to know a little bit more about you as a person.
Sure. I grew up in a little town with less than 3,000 on the edge of the Ozarks in Missouri, Windsor, Missouri. And I had a little aptitude for music, and when I was in junior high, we got a brochure in the mail about a band camp here at KU in the summer, the Midwestern Music and Art Camp. And at that time, it was one of the top two music camps in the country. It was 6 weeks long, and different guest conductors came each week. It was really, really good. So I ended up coming to that for 5 years before I came to KU, fell in love with the KU and the campus in Lawrence. Worked at that camp for 5 years while I was at KU, got a music ed degree. While I was at KU, I started a jazz group. And we were very fortunate. We did really well, made records and traveled and did national TV shows while we were in college and stuff. And so I ended up staying in Lawrence, buying a music store, and then starting a nightclub here that's now called the Jazz House. Originally it was called the Jazz Place. Yeah. I started that in 74 and had it until 82. And also traveled with my band during the late 60s, 70s, and pretty much all of the 80s. So I kind of took the traditional route in the ministry. I was a jazz trumpet player and a nightclub owner. I grew up in a, quote, religious family. My parents were very involved in the church, and was there all the time, but it was a real dead church. Nothing really happened there. I had an uncle, though, that was very influential in my life, and he was an evangelical pastor. I went to a church camp of his and accepted Christ when I was like 11 years old and really felt a calling to be a quote, preacher. But I didn't, I went back home then to this church where nothing was happening. I didn't get discipled, didn't learn anything anymore. And I had a very real conversion experience, and I continued to pray and to go to church, but my prayers were basically, God, can you fix this? Can you get me out of this? Can you help me with this? And it was all centered on me. And music sort of became my God, and I really got immersed into jazz and jazz studies, and that was just the biggest thing to me. And so I certainly believed in God. I would say theologically I was saved, but I wasn't walking with God or depending on Him or anything at all. And then it's interesting how God lets things play out. My band, we were very fortunate, and in the jazz world, for the most part, you play in a different town every night. You're really fortunate to live in to be in one town for like a week. Anything more than that's just kind of unbelievable, and you don't generally make a lot of money. And it's while it's rewarding, it's a really hard life. We traveled a lot, and we're in different towns every night for a long time. But then we got a job in 1985 at a new hotel that opened up in Kansas City downtown, and the theme of the hotel was jazz. And we got a job there playing five nights a week for 3 years, and it was ecstasy as far as jazz musicians were concerned. It paid a lot. When other jazz musicians came to town, they would stay there and they would come and sit in with us, and name and lights and all that kind of stuff. We had standing room only crowds on Tuesday nights. Tuesday through Saturday for several months. It was really, from a jazz standpoint, from a career standpoint, it was unbelievable. But what happened was, after the first few months of that, I found myself going back into the dressing room like on breaks and thinking, wow, this is as good as it gets, and it's not doing anything for me. I'm not, you know, I thought this would be it. You know, I've made the records, I've done the TV shows, I've got this long-term, well-paying job, and I'm still empty. And so it was very disappointing to me and disillusioning. And, you know, so I'm I'm thinking, well, now what? And during that time, I met a guy through a business thing who just seemed to have everything that that I was looking for. He was happy, he was funny, people liked him, his wife and kids respected him, he was a really good businessman, he was in demand as a speaker and consultant and stuff. So I started having lunch with him every week, and one day I just said, hey, you know, I'm not happy, it looks like you are, I want what you have. And he said, well, I'm a Christian. And I said, well, you know, I am too. I accepted Christ and went to church, you know, vote Republican, recycle, what else is there? And I really said that. And he said, well, I have a, he said, no, I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. I'd never heard that term. I was my late 30s. And I'm thinking shaved head, people at airports, you know, trying to get you to buy flowers and move into a cult and stuff. I mean, it just, I wasn't thrilled with what he said, but I was really attracted to his lifestyle and way that, and he was real perceptive. He didn't invite me to church or anything. He said, Paul, do you have a Bible? I said, no. And he said, did you know that they have them in today's language? I said, no. And all I knew was King James from when I was a kid, which I couldn't understand. And he said, well, he said, it, you know, you're telling me you want something different. I'd encourage you to get a Bible in today's language, start reading it in the New Testament, and just tell God, just ask him to reveal himself to you. And I was so desperate and so hungry and so empty that I didn't have any place else to go, so I said okay. So I bought a Bible, New American Standard, and I started reading it. I had learned, I think this is true, I'd learned in some business things that I'd done, that if you will really commit yourself, immerse yourself into studying any subject for 2 hours a day for a couple of years, you can pretty much get to be an expert at it. So I thought, I'm going to do this. So I committed 2 hours a day to reading and praying, and sure enough, almost immediately, God started speaking to me and explaining scripture to me and telling me things, and it, my life just like immediately started changing. And I got involved in a businessman's Bible study with a parachurch group called the Navigators, and guy kind of took me under his wing and was my mentor. That was in the late 80s, and he's now in his 80s and is still my mentor. He lives in Kansas City. But over the course of just, you know, a very few years of time, actually that would have been in the kind of the middle 80s, you know, I really started developing a personal relationship with Jesus Christ and understanding what that meant, what he meant, who he is, and felt God calling me into the ministry. And so I, at that time, I was going to church here in town. Actually, I was on the board of the largest church here in town, but had no idea. I mean, nobody was ever encouraged to have a Bible, to read it, to take Christianity seriously. And so I ended up going to another church, getting involved there where the Bible was believed and taught, and decided to, you know, felt God calling me to go into the ministry. So I had a couple of other businesses then too. It took me about 2 years to sell them and turn them over to other people without, you know, to do it ethically and in a good way. my dad and I went on staff at this other church as music minister and evangelism pastor. It was a it was a good church, but it was very traditional, and I realized pretty early on that none of my friends from my music background, business background, were going to come there and listen to organ music and stand up and sit down and read things that you don't understand and hear sermons about if you don't go to India or Africa and become a missionary, you're pond scum, you know. And so I tried to change that church, and that caused great consternation for both me and them. And in the process, I felt God calling me to start a church. I had been going to Chicago pretty often to visit a church called Willow Creek Community Church, and I was going to do some seminars and some things there. Got very involved with them, and felt God calling me to start a church in Lawrence that would could reach people who had never been to church, or people who had been to church but had bad experiences, and at some point in time after they left home said, "I'm done with church, I'm not going back." But then what I knew because of my own experience and my friends was that that happens to a lot of people, but then you get into your 30s or 40s or whatever, and you go through a divorce, or a spouse dies, or your kids go nuts, or you lose your job or whatever, or in my case you have some degree of success and it's not fulfilling, and you go, okay, you know, what else is there? Maybe there's God. I think I'll try God. I think he's home on Sunday morning, so I'll go to church and find out. But what I found was literally a lot of people who did that would try church, would go to church, and just could not relate. As a classically trained musician, I love classical music. I love organ music. But nobody I know listens to it on the radio or has CDs of it, and nobody I know can relate to anybody wearing a robe unless they've been in court fairly often, and that's not a good experience. So what I found was people would go to, you know, they would hunger for God, they'd have a need for God, not really knowing what that meant. They'd go to church, they'd hear music they couldn't relate to, they'd be asked to say things they don't believe and stand up and sit down and not know why, and listen to music that they couldn't relate to. And what I found was, I didn't come up with this on my own, through Willow Creek and other places, what I found was people would go, dot, 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 God's not relevant. I think I'll try the Elks Club or get in a bowling league or whatever, literally. And so so I felt God calling me to have a church and use my music abilities and my background to have a church that would still present the good news, but without all the trappings of religion. So we started this church almost 20 years ago. We started in September of 1991 in our basement, and then we moved to some different places for a few years at a time. We've been in this building for almost 11 years, and I'll give you a little tour if you want after a while, but this was a business and we gutted it and remodeled it, but we specifically did not try to make it look like a church. No stained glass windows, no pews, no choir, no organ. We have a band, singers, and we play, it's 2 or 3 degrees beyond what would be called contemporary Christian music. I mean, it's this is a very trite word, but it's really cutting edge stuff. A lot of this stuff is original stuff, and it's really a couple of guitars, bass, drums, keyboards, a couple of singers. I mean, it's very, I don't have a word to describe it, but it's sort of the antithesis of choirs and organs. And we don't ask people to stand up and sit down and recite anything that they don't believe, and but we do. We're very conservative in what we do believe. I believe the Bible's the inspired word of God, and in its original language, it's infallible. You know, I've certainly come to understand that there are bad translations and words that are mistranslated in every version, and so. But we also talk and teach and emphasize a personal relationship with Jesus, and our goal is to get people to hear from God themselves, and let you know, not to try to teach them what to live like, what to do, how to, you got to do this, you got to do that, you need to be involved in this movement or that movement. Our goal is just to get people to hear from God themselves. So as a result, we have people who are very liberal here. We have people who are very conservative. A lot of them don't even know what each other believes, because we focus on hearing from God and living out the grace of the gospel. And I'll get you some coffee and tell you kind of how we do that.
Sure.
You like it? You want to do that?
All right. I would be interested in hearing a little bit more about establishing the church. You're talking about how it kind of got started in 1991, and you didn't want it to look like church. You wanted it to be something that people could feel comfortable come that didn't come from these traditional church backgrounds. So tell me a little bit more logistically about what was going on in developing this church and how you got it going.
Okay. Well, we met the first few months in the basement of our house. We started out with about a dozen people, that included kids. And then as we grew, we moved to KU. We met in Murphy Hall at Swarthout Recital Hall for a couple of months. And then our first building was at 8th and Vermont. It's now the Eldridge Annex or something like that. And we had the upstairs of that, which also was used as a dance studio for, for little kids and that kind of classical dance type thing. We were there for 3 years, and then we moved to where Maselli's is at 1046 New Hampshire, and we were there for 5 years. We rented those places, and then we bought this building over Christmas and New Year's of 99 and 2000, and remodeled it, and actually had our first services here in March of 2000. And so, I found out, much to my amazement, that you don't have to have a college degree, let alone have gone to Bible college or seminary, to be a pastor, to start a church, to be any local church can, in their own articles of incorporation or whatever bylaws, can have their own ordination standards. So you can be, the board of a local church, which can be however many people you want it to, can have whatever credentialing that you want to have for ordination. Now, according to the IRS, to be able to take some tax deductions and things like that for being a minister and having a housing allowance and things like that, I think there are 11 or so things that you have to do, at least half of those, which are preaching, teaching, serving communion, baptizing, doing funerals, marriages, counseling. Can't remember what the other thing. And so, I do all those things, as do several other people here. So I continued to, we started the church. We put together a band, some singers, got some sound people, started a little Sunday school program, and I continue to be very involved in Willow Creek and go there for training and listen to lots of tapes and CDs and do individual studying and correspondence courses and things like that. And other people got involved in the church who, had men or were pastors. We incorporated. We got we applied for and got our non-tax status and all of that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we've been an official legal not-for-profit, non-tax religious entity, you know, since like mm-hmm. the first year. And, you know, then we just went about trying to, you know, invite people to come and hear the gospel in a sort of a non-threatening way. And we really put an emphasis on reaching unchurched people just until the last 2 years. And, you know, during the first, up until a couple of years ago, we had a lot of people come through our doors. A lot of people accept Christ and get excited about Him. But then because of our size and our nature and our emphasis, a lot of people would then go on to other churches that had more in-depth teaching and more things, you know, of that nature to offer. And we just didn't have the horses or the ability to do that, and didn't feel like that was our calling. But in the last couple of years, through a number of different experiences and events, you know, God has shown me and shown us that more of what grace is and what it means, and that we're here to reach people who unchurched people who don't know God or never have, but also to everybody who's here. Kind of our main calling now is to teach and preach and show people what grace means on a much fuller extent. So that's kind of our, well, that's one part of our story. We've also been very, very community service oriented. in the mid-90s, we had over a year, we had an after-school program for at-risk youth. The gang situation was pretty bad, pretty high profile in Lawrence then. And so we had a program every day after school, and then all day, 5 days a week in the summers, for kids that where we taught them contemporary music, video stuff, computer stuff, acting, singing, dancing, cooking, video stuff, some other things. And we had a lot of volunteers and a couple of paid staff, and we had about 50 kids who regularly came to that every day. We had about 150 who were involved, but they didn't all come every day. And we wrote, they did it with our help. We wrote some anti-drug musicals that they put on, and made a video and some different stuff. And that was a really cool thing. It was primarily for junior high kids, but we had a few either side of that a year or two. That was a neat thing for the community that we did. And then in 1999, we had a doctor come to town from California who came back here to be closer to family. And he had, in addition to his family practice in California, he had started a free medical clinic that he did out of an RV that he had fitted out to be a doctor's office, where in California he would go around two afternoons a week to places where migrant workers lived. Most of them were probably illegal, and they had no health insurance, and he would treat them out of that. And he wanted to do something similar here. And so he started a clinic at our church on Saturday mornings in October of 99. We were still on New Hampshire Street then. And then as we moved here in 2000, that really grew, and it was all volunteers, him and other doctors and nurses and people. And we got to where in 3 years' time, we were seeing over 300 patients a month here, and it literally took over the whole building and a huge part of my time and attention. It was all a good thing. But, you know, every day there would be patients lined up to come and get in. And our entryway and where patients checked in and stuff was the church entryway here. And then all of our Sunday school rooms were, we would take, on early Monday morning, we'd take all the Sunday school stuff out and we would move in things like this, patient beds and all that kind of stuff. And then all week long, we'd have the clinic. And then on Saturdays, we would take this stuff and put it in storage and bring back the Sunday school stuff. And it was a really neat thing. A ton of people in the church were involved in it. And it outgrew the church. And so I was friends with some other evangelical charismatic pastors in town. And so we all, six of us, our churches went together. And we moved the clinic out of here and we moved it to Riverfront Plaza and changed the name of it, and we called it the Leo Center. And our doctor went there, and it became a full-time medical clinic, benevolent center, food pantry, and Christian counseling center. And it started, once we moved there, we had full-time paid people. I think at one time we had 17 paid people, and I was the CEO of that. I did that sort of half-time and led the church half-time. You know, most of the people in the church here were involved in that. And I mean, it really grew, and we got to where we helped hundreds of people medically and benevolence money and food and stuff like that. And I was the chairman of the board and the president of it, and our founding doctor was the medical director. And then over the course of time, we hired somebody to be the CEO, and I stayed the president of the board. So I wasn't as involved. During the course of all of that, there was a young man here who grew up in a church, came here when he was in grade school, helped with sound and all different things, worked as a custodian in college and stuff, wanted to go into youth ministry and did. A really neat guy, married my daughter, and he went to an alternative seminary in Kansas City and was our youth pastor half-time while he did that, became our associate pastor here, and was, he and I were very, very close. And he got cancer in May of 2008, and rapid growing. I had his leg amputated shortly after that, and had real heavy duty chemo, one out of every 3 weeks for 6 months. Would be in the med center for a week, have the chemo, this is after the amputation, then would come home and take a week to recover, and then he'd have a week that he was sort of do normal activities, you know, stayed involved here with the youth and stuff. And then it came back over at Christmas time, and over the next 6 months he was in the med center almost all the time, and then he died in May of 2009. And my daughter, his wife, and their son, my grandson, she was at the med center with him almost all the time. We kept their grandson, and then when he died, then they only had one income, and she wasn't able to keep their house, so she and her grandson moved in with me and my wife and her mom. And so when he first, shortly after he first got sick, I resigned from being president of the board and then resigned from the board at the Leo Center. I couldn't do that and do his duties here at the church too, and he'd be the father and grandfather and all that kind of stuff. So I never was able to go back and be involved there. And my daughter and grandson still live with us. That's been a really neat thing. I mean, not what she would have chosen, of course, but so that took a toll on the church and on the youth, you know, and on me. You know, we all prayed that he would be healed and had lots of prayer meetings and different things like that, and you know, and God chose not to heal him. And so that was some people that grew stronger through that. Some people, you know, grew disillusioned and thought, you know, here's a guy who's sold out for the Lord and he's a pastor and he's 29 years old, you know, why would God let him die? And so, you know, some of the youth kids, you know, quit coming, and some of the well, some adults too. And so that, you know, the church took a kind of a hit in some attendance and involvement then, and we certainly lost our connection with the Leo Center. And then during the course of that time, the Leo Center CEO and board kind of decided to go a different direction, and rather than it really be a Christian clinic where the doctor could take time with patients and pray with them and get to know them, and then if they needed help counseling wise or whatever, that we could do that, they moved to much more of a medical clinic for people with no insurance, and going to rather than getting donations and support from private individuals and churches and things like that, to getting government grants, which has necessitated that some strings are attached with that, that they do things differently. So the doctor who was there, who had started the clinic here, decided that he really didn't want to go that direction, and so he resigned, and we then, a few months later, started the clinic back up here as we initially had, but just one day a week, because that's all the resources that we had to do it right now. And rather than do it downstairs in the Sunday school rooms, we have a one room up here that's we remodeled my son-in-law's office to just be a patient room, and then I use half of my office to, and so on Wednesdays we kind of cordon this part off and see patients in there. And we have people here who pray with patients, and we do counseling and stuff like that. And so we asked for a suggested donation of $25 for a doctor's visit, but we make it clear if people can't pay that, we just send them for free. So it's all volunteer. We have expenses, of course, for the equipment and the medications and malpractice insurance and stuff like that. So our church is not big enough to, I mean, we provide the space and utilities and office equipment and all that kind of stuff, but we get donations from other people outside the church to help pay for, you know, the medical costs. So we're kind of back to our roots in that kind of service that we were actually 11 years ago now. That's where we are.
Okay. So then looking kind of at the people that attend your church right now, can you give me a description, kind of breakdown of demographic size and what they do in terms of involvement with the church?
Sure. We kind of fluctuate between maybe 175 and 225 people that regularly come here. Not everybody comes every week. Mm-hmm. So on any given Sunday morning, there'll be 125 to 150 people here. Right now, the demographics are pretty heavily 20, 30 something. Grad students at KU, young families, you know, people just maybe starting their careers in teaching or law or whatever. That probably makes up half of our people, and then another 35 or so percent of people in their 40s, 50s, early 60s, just a few older retired people. So it's basically a pretty young church. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of small group, like Bible studies. We have on Monday nights, we have a group that's called 20, 30-something that rotates at different people's houses. And they lead that themselves. They'll do different Bible studies or watch videos or talk about, you know, just particular topics and stuff. They have dinner together. They have sort of a theme night thing. It'll be Mexican dinner or whatever, that kind of stuff. They do some service projects. They'll occasionally go out and, you know, rebuild a porch that's falling in for somebody that they find out. They have a garden in the summer that they all work at and take turns, and they share the food from that as well as give some of it away. Really, really neat, involved group. And the people in that group are involved in other things too, playing in bands, singing, doing technical stuff. We have other small groups. We have a Tuesday night women's group called Trading Graces. We have a Thursday morning women's group called Trading Graces. They study different things and just hang out together. We have our youth group meets on Wednesday night. There are several kids that don't go to church here or go to church anywhere that are part of that. We have a Sunday night sort of leadership small group. We have another women's group on Wednesday night called Supper Sisters. It's primarily for women in their 40s, 50s, 60s. They do a Bible study and have dinner together. There's some other Bible studies. We have a noon Wednesday called Grace with Gray Bible study that I lead here. And then Wednesday evening we have we call it Stone Soup. We have a dinner that we make, people bring canned stuff, vegetables or whatever, bread and things. It's just like a soup and bread thing where we make it that afternoon. We hang out and have dinner and just, you know, get to know people better in an informal setting. We do some things like the children's ministry. Sunday school is at children's at the same time that church is upstairs. Kids are with us for the first three or four songs that we do, and then they go downstairs to their ministry. But they do some things too, like we teach about and we use their offerings to go for some overseas ministries, like particularly you know, buying a cow and a couple of goats for a family, those types of things. And so so they see how you know you can show Christ's love in a practical way by helping people feed them and get them off their feet, help them financially, as well as, you know, at the same time tell them the reason we do this is because of what Christ has done for us. So
okay.
Yeah.
So then with each of these small groups or various ministries that are going on too, I was interested in hearing about leadership. Who heads them all up? You mentioned that you were doing this one Bible study, but is it people within your congregation that are leading kind of separate ones, or do they volunteer to do it too, or do you pick them? How does that work out?
Good question. We have on Sunday morning, we have five different teachers, preachers, or whatever you want to call us, all of whom, I mean, they're very good, and a couple of them are head and shoulders better, more effective preachers, teachers than I am. So we share the teaching on Sunday morning, and I will teach about two times a month, and the other three like once every couple of months, or sometimes a little more than that. Three men and two women. So we have women very involved, fully involved in leadership, teaching, everything here. Those others, one of them is a husband and wife team who came here. They had led a Christian counseling ministry in Phoenix for 6 years and developed a discipleship ministry and course. And they are both just excellent teachers. They both teach on Sunday morning as well as lead other. Each one leads a small group. Then our halftime youth pastor, halftime worship leader, also is one of the Sunday morning teachers. He leads the youth group. Then our children's ministry person, who's like halftime paid staff, she teaches once a month, and she is, well, she's like 41 or so, but she's just became a Christian and started growing here in this church. So neither she nor our youth pastor or anybody else, actually none of us, have been to Bible college or seminary. We've all kind of taken different paths to do that. So those folks lead the small groups, as well as my wife leads one. The 20-30 something thing is led by two couples. One of them, the guy does have a degree in biblical studies from a Catholic university. He grew up Catholic before he came here. And then the other couple, they both went to an evangelical college in Minneapolis, and she's a social worker, and he's getting a doctorate at KU in communication, but I think his bachelor's degree might have been in something the equivalent of religious studies. Mm-hmm. So they're probably the most academically qualified people we have. So that's the kind of people that we have. Sometimes somebody will offer to lead a small group and, you know, say that they want to do that, they feel called to do that, and assuming that I, you know them and, you know, have seen them demonstrate their relationship with the Lord and realize that they're not whacked out or going to do something weird, then, you know, I will support them and have them do that. Occasionally there'll be somebody new who comes in who wants to do something, and I realize they're not ready for it, or they believe something really, they've got an agenda that they want to do, and mm-hmm. and so they, you know, that didn't happen, and they leave and go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, kind of building off of this a little bit, I've heard you mention discipleship a few times throughout talking out in your own experience. You're saying how after you first accepted Christ, you were not really feeling that you had that discipleship, or then a little bit later, when talking about a lot of people would come here and convert, but then leave towards other churches, right. And then just talking about this leadership couple as well that had developed some discipleship trainings. What is the role of discipleship within this church as well, or how do you address that?
Well, our whole goal, Emily, is to help people hear from God themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't want to teach them how to think or tell them what I think God is saying for them. And so helping people hear from God themselves is what I think is, well, that's our definition of discipleship.
Okay.
And that encompasses, we talk a lot about a love revealed relationship, and that our relationship with Christ is totally based on love. He is love, and it's not a fearful relationship. It's not him watching for us to do something wrong and zapping us. It's totally based on love, but there's nothing we can relate to that, humanly speaking, and so he literally has to reveal to us what that's like. The way he does that is through the Bible, through prayer, through being with other believers that are, you know, maybe have experienced hearing from him more. We have some specific, the Bible is our main tool for doing that. We do have a discipleship course, if you want to call it that. It's called SALT, which stands for Seven Areas of Life Training. And the couple who moved here from Phoenix, they developed this along with a few other people, and it was, they took some of the principles from a very successful Christian counseling discipleship ministry in Phoenix, and they have offices all over the world. And they kind of culled this down into seven different areas: spiritual, psychological, social, physical, financial, parental, marital, and that's those seven. And we have a sort of a workbook for each of those seven areas that has four lessons in it. It's all based on scripture, and each one of those has a fairly easy to remember and duplicatable diagram that we learn that some, you can literally, you know, draw something on a napkin to show somebody. And so that's kind of we use that a lot. We have people, we do a pretty much every year we'll do a 1 week intensive training seminar, and it's like all day long. People need to work their schedule so they can take that and then learn that, and then we use that in sometimes that is a class that we use. Sometimes we'll take a message on Sunday morning, and it will be just one of those messages, or we relate it to other things. So we have that. I don't like the word course or program or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a something that we use. And then we have a I'll show you this too when we go in the auditorium. We have a set of books that have been different books, different authors that have been really helpful to us, that we, you know, recommend people get and read and talk about and discuss and understand, that have been very helpful. So it's kind of like a little mini curriculum thing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Sorry, as I'm kind of scribbling some last things down, I also was interested, kind of going back, you were talking about some of the portions of the medical ministry, and you had mentioned having this suggested donation, and I was thinking, well, medical things are very expensive.
Okay.
how do you fund all that goes on here?
It's a great question. From time to time, I have people ask me to do interviews with them, and when we get done with that, I ask them for $1,000 each.
I came unprepared. It's good though.
I've been in Lawrence for, you know, since 1965, and so I have a number of contacts, acquaintances, friends who know, you know, what God's called us to do here and the need for it and stuff, who go to other churches or maybe don't go to churches at all. They, different ones of them, will donate, will help from time to time. We just started a little campaign called Give Hope, and basically we say to people, our suggested donation is $25 for a patient visit. If you could give $25 a month to this ministry, you will give hope to a person, a lot of times homeless people, but sometimes it's, you know, people who work but can't afford and don't have health insurance. You can provide a doctor's visit for them. And so our expenses just for the clinic are about $4,000 a month. Malpractice is insurance is unbelievable. That's why you like over $13,000. And then our other things. And so we've kind of divided that up. What we would like to have, what we hope to have, is 160 people who will will give $25 a month, and that will pay, that will provide $4,000 to do this. So we get people who will give, you know, X hundred dollars occasionally or that kind of stuff, but we would like to, and I think, you know, the Lord has showed us this, that this is kind of a community thing. It's not just our church, and we want to find, identify people all over the community who go, yeah, that's a need, I'd like to be a part of that. I'm not a doctor, I can't go volunteer, but I can give $25. So that's what, we don't have enough to cover that yet, so we're hitting up my friends for large donations when we get to that point.
Good. Well, I was looking at the clock, and definitely over an hour here. So I guess I'll wrap up, and I want to ask if you have any memories or experiences that you wanted to share, or things that should go down on the record from your experiences with this body.
Before we started the medical clinic, I didn't believe this at the time, and you couldn't have convinced me, but I was pretty cold-hearted, not very compassionate. I would, send $25 to the Salvation Army every year and think I had done my part for those people. Well, when we started doing the medical clinic here, quote, those people were here every day, and we'd serve them coffee and donuts and stuff, and I would literally sit down with them and visit with them, and got to know people and became friends with them, and I realized, you know, they weren't those people, it was all us. And so, you know, I get to know their story. I'd talk to somebody who'd come in on a day like this, or maybe much colder, who'd have pneumonia, and you know, a doctor would, you know, give them a shot, give them some penicillin, ampicillin or something, and then they'd go right back out and sleep under the bridge, and we'd realize that, you know, they're not going to get well from that. So memories of seeing what a great need there is for health care, and how you know, so many people just don't have any hope there. Literally the only place they can go is to, now there are a couple of other good clinics now. There's Healthcare Access and there's the Leo Center. Both of them charge, and there's a long waiting time there. At Healthcare Access, it's like until March. And at the Leo Center, it's, last time we called it was 10 days. So, plus you do have to pay. So, there's need for even more than, you know, than what we can do. So getting to know people and their stories and their situations, that's been just overall a huge memory. Now, through that, we've seen God do some really neat things. We're, you know, the guy who was in here when you came in before, he was at one time was homeless, really in bad shape physically, and didn't know the Lord, and I mean just a lot of different things. And since then, boy, you know, with him trusting the Lord and getting some medical help, with people helping him with different things, really his life has turned around. Great success story. And now he's pretty much centered around helping other people. He's disabled, he can't work, but he gives people rides to different places all the time, different things like that. So some neat things like that, you know, marriages strengthened, you know, kids turning around, stuff like that. We had a, there was one, this always sticks out in my mind, one day when the clinic was first here, it was in the summer. It was a summer where it was like over 100 every day for like 11 straight days. It was really hot. And there was a woman who came in to be treated by a doctor. She was hypothermia or whatever it is, dehydrated, whatever. And she was in her 40s, was attractive, fairly well-dressed. And it turned out that the doctor brought her in here for me to meet with and pray with. And turned out just by happenstance, she didn't have any family. All of her parents died, and she was from another part of the country. Nobody. She'd moved here, been married for a few years, didn't have kids or anything, and her husband left her for a younger woman, and she had nothing. She'd never worked. She didn't. I can't remember if she drove or not, but she'd been, you know, middle class, maybe upper middle class. No job, no skills, never worked. Within 2 months' time, she found herself homeless, and never ever thought that that would happen. And I mean, she was, in addition to being malnourished and dehydrated and all that kind of stuff, I mean, just emotionally, she was just like, man, what happened? Living under the bridge and all that kind of stuff. And so we helped her medically, and you know, I was able to talk to her, give her some hope and encouragement, talk to her about the Lord. We got her into a shelter type house thing in Kansas City, where, you know, for a couple of weeks, you know, they really helped her, got her back on her feet. Still really hot, you know, she came back to Lawrence, you know, was doing, you know, really still homeless, but had, you know, made some great changes. And a couple of days later, she died from heat exposure and exhaustion, sleeping down by the river. And I mean, that's a memory that just, you know, doesn't go away. I don't know if she accepted Christ, but, you know, I like to think that she did. I don't know. I actually, quote, preached her funeral. So having the opportunity to be involved with her and see what real life, you know, right here in River City is like, and what can happen to people who, through ostensibly no fault of their own, and see what people are going through, it just really not only made an impression on me, as you can see, but it helps me to, I don't always do this, but it helps me to, you know, when somebody comes in the door at church or comes to the clinic or whatever, to realize that they got a story, and you know, to hopefully not to judge them and not to think, well, they made poor choices or whatever. You know, we've seen a lot of people come to Christ, and a lot of lives change, and had a lot of kids grow up in a church who have gone on to become ministers, youth pastors, and different things, and a number of them. So, a lot of really neat things, some things like that that are stick out, mm-hmm, you know.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, anything else that you want to add, or?
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for taking your time.
Sure.